Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Prep Life Podcast. This is your founder and CEO of Glam Girl Bikini, Amy Anger. And today I'm joined by not only my fabulous co-host, but also Mr. Dr. Bill Campbell. So first of all, Chris, welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us again. We really enjoyed our last episode that we recorded with you, and we had so many positive reviews and so much good feedback, and everybody just loves hearing from you. So for those of you that did miss the previous episode, can you just give us a brief bio of yourself and introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. My name is Bill Campbell. I got my PhD in exercise, nutrition, and preventive health from Baylor University. I am currently a professor of exercise science at the University of South Florida, which is in Tampa, Florida. And I direct the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory there, where most of my research focuses on optimizing one's physique within a maintainable lifestyle. So we do diets, we do macronutrient manipulations, dietary supplement studies. And one thing that's consistent throughout almost all of my research is a resistance training component. So resistance training serves as like the foundation exercise mode. And then we seek to lose body fat, maintain or even gain muscle mass through different nutrition and supplemental approaches.
Yeah, and today we wanted to specifically talk with you about your newest venture with your Body by Science review. And we just wanted to kind of talk to you about, first of all, what motivated you to start putting this together, and kind of what is your target audience that you're aiming to impact the most with this research?
Well, that's good. So motivating factor would be I've always wanted to do something entrepreneurial. So I've always had that. I'm a professor and there's not much opportunities to do that. So I was like, I just probably for much of my adult life, just do something outside of academia, but yet something that's aligned with my passion, and my passion is my research. So I think that's probably the primary reason, just to provide a service or in this case, a digital product that can help people and that also fulfills my need of just, again, executing on all of these business books that I read, customer service books like that. That's kind of like just my hobby. So I'm living that dream, so to speak. And if I get a little bit more serious, it is kind of frustrating, and sometimes it makes me angry with how much misinformation is out there about dieting and exercise. And as you both know, there's a lot of unethical people that prey upon the most vulnerable people in that space, just giving them information that makes the person a lot of money, the influencer, the business person, whoever they are, but is not helping anybody long term. So that's my altruistic motivation as well, like just putting out scientific information, which is not sexy. It's very hard to sell education. People want quick fixes, and everything about what I educate and my research, there is no quick fix. It is not. So I know it's not sexy, but at least I can feel good about trying to do my part. So those are the motivations, and the ideal audience would be somebody. Well, let me explain who it's probably not for. It's if somebody is not exercising, they have no desire to ever lift a weight or to go for a run, this is not for them. This assumes that somebody has a fitness lifestyle. And in particular, if somebody has a fitness lifestyle and they're serious about their training, and in particular, if they want to build muscle and have lower than average body fat levels, this is exactly who it's for. So bodybuilders get a lot of value out of this. Mm-hmm. I would say it's a little bit more, I mean, I could make a bodybuilding research review, but I'm trying to serve the people who are a little bit more non-competitive. So people who want to look like a bodybuilder, bikini competitor, figure competitor, but never want to actually step on stage. So that would be like my wife is a perfect example of that. So I'm giving them all of the research, the latest research, the historical landmark research to help them maintain a lean physique that obviously we can appreciate is not maintainable for, you know, when people are stepping on stage. That is a point in time, but how close can we get to that while living our lives? So that's kind of what I would say is the target audience. And here's a tagline. It's for people who want to optimize their physiques within a maintainable lifestyle.
I like that. And I know that you, so we obviously are a, you know, very much a bodybuilding type lifestyle. And that's what we promote with our clients. But we also have, you know, lifestyle clients and competitors equally. But we are primarily female, you know, owned and operated. And I know that you are kind of unique in terms of, you know, a typically male dominated area of research. You are motivated to have some content that regard females in the industry and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So one thing that's been impressed upon me just as a male, I guess, fitness professional is that it is what I think you said, what I've heard. It's very male dominated and it's sad. I've got two daughters, so it kind of, I guess, just stinks. If a female and male have the equal talent and equal preparation in fitness, it seems to me that a female just has to work harder, has to do better to get the same amount of respect or gravitas that the male does. And again, that may or may not be true, but that is my impression, and that is what female professionals have told me, and I believe that to be true. So I do have a platform, right? I'm a professor. I have a research lab. So I would say first I have a meritocracy. So the best people will rise to the top in terms of running my lab. But it just so happens that most of the time it's females that are the best, at least at the age groups that I deal with. So that's kind of my research lab aspect. Now, with my research review, I just make sure that there's a female perspective in my research review. And I don't have demographics on who buys my research review. It might be more males. It might be more females. But I can appreciate everything being male dominant and always from a male perspective has to be frustrating. Again, I'm blind to it, so to speak, because I am a male. So with every issue, I always have two experts. I have a female expert that applies the research to their clientele, and I have a male expert that applies the research that I'm summarizing to their clientele. So those are just my observations of the fitness space and me attempting to do a small part to provide opportunity that I was probably given I'll just say given with not much consideration.
So it's an issue too. I know, like with female menstrual cycles and things like that, it's harder to get all variables the same when it comes to research. But you're in your lab, you're also getting some data on females in these studies and things like that, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we do. I'd say most of my research is solely focused on females. Now, I have yet to handle or scale the mountain of the menstrual cycle. That's probably on the horizon, but that can. Now, let me just say this. What I've typically done, or actually not typically, what I've done is I run my studies. Let's say I have all female subjects. And I don't account for the menstrual cycle, but I account for total body water so that if there is a retention of body water in the muscles or total body water, I account for that, which in effect does now wash out if that were influencing lean mass gains or weight gain. So I do account for that. But
okay.
I think Yeah, there's a need, and I think it's coming. I was just at a conference in Canada, and there was an entire talk on starting to do better with females, and in particular, working around and accounting for specific variables that the menstrual cycle introduces to a female fit population.
Interesting. Well, before we, get too far into the weeds, let's start with just the first study that you presented in your inaugural issue. If you can just give us a little bit of background information about, the study that was regarding ideal protein distribution throughout the day and then maximizing the muscle mass for that.
Okay, so this study, and by the way, this is in the inaugural issue, and this issue is free for anybody. And the reason I do that is I want people to see, is this something that they would like? So this is, you can get this, exactly the studies we're discussing, for free to see if it's something you would like. So often you get the question, or there's just a lot of uncertainty around, how often do you need to eat protein, or how much protein for that matter? Like those are things that are often debated. So now this particular study, this had males, this was only males, and they were non-resistance trained. So they weren't resistance training. And essentially what they wanted to do, they wanted to put them on a program where they were lifting weights. So they wanted them to build muscle. And their primary research question was, is there a preferred distribution of the protein that they're going to eat throughout the day? Is it better that it's spread out approximately evenly, or does it not matter? So I guess it's important to say what most people naturally do, at least in the American culture, is known as a protein skewing approach. And that is where we have very little protein for breakfast. We have a moderate amount of protein for lunch, and then a really large amount of protein, relatively speaking, for dinner. So it's little, more, and then a lot at dinner. What this study did was they said, okay, we're going to let the natural protein distribution, we want to have a group that follows that while they're resistance training. But we also want to have, what our main question is, what if we said we want to have a moderate amount for breakfast, a moderate amount for lunch, and a moderate amount for dinner. So we want to have the same amount of protein throughout the day, but make sure it's more evenly spread throughout the day. So historically in our space, that makes sense, but there's never actually been a study to validate that. What there has been is, I think I'm aware of two, definitely one, and I believe two different studies that looked at a similar type of approach, but only at the cellular level, when they looked at like muscle protein synthesis responses to protein feedings. And both of those studies seem to indicate, yes, it's better at the cellular level, at the muscle fiber level, that you would have evenly distributed protein feedings throughout the day. But does that ultimately build more muscle? We don't know, because it's never been done until now. So this group of researchers did this. So again, one group had protein skewing. The other group more evenly divided their protein throughout the course of the day while they were resistance training. And the resistance training, it was a 12-week study. And one thing I like about that, that is definitely long enough to detect differences in muscle mass. I get a little bit concerned when studies are 6 weeks long or 4 weeks long and the conclusions are no difference, it didn't work. Well, 4 weeks might not be long enough for adaptation to take place. Sure. So it's a little bit lazy on the part of a researcher to design a study that's only 4 weeks when you're looking at muscle hypertrophy outcomes. And sadly, a lot of studies do that, which can give the wrong outcomes, or at least not give what is probably more true just because of a flawed study design. So this study, 12 weeks long, they had their subjects resistance trained 3 days per week. And what they found at the end of the study was that the group that more evenly distributed their protein throughout the day, and specifically they had a high protein breakfast, or let's say a moderate breakfast with protein, moderate protein lunch, moderate to high protein intake at dinner, they gain more muscle mass than the other group. And I'm just going to get in the weeds here for a moment. It wasn't statistically significant, but there's also another measure that's called an effect size, and the effect size was rather large. So as a exercise scientist, you look at the effect size, and that tells you there was a clear difference here in this study. So my interpretation of the study was, if you have your total amount of protein throughout the day, it's best to evenly distribute that throughout the day, rather than only have a little bit for breakfast or maybe a little bit for dinner. Try to divide it out so it's approximately even. And over time, that will result in a greater muscle hypertrophic response.
Did they, one thing about this study that I had a question on is, was the resistance training happening in the morning, or like, did they mention what time of day it was? Just the reason why I ask is just, I feel like nutrient timing is so important when it comes to muscle protein synthesis. And I'm wondering if these individuals all like worked out in the morning, and if they didn't have much protein around the workout, I just wondered if that had a factor to play into that.
Okay. So I'm trying to remember if I have that data. I'm going to tell you, you need to do your own research review, because that is a really good question. So I would phrase that, if nutrient timing does matter, then that should be considered in this study. And I don't think they controlled for that, or if they did, it was the workouts were between breakfast and lunch, like in the mm-hmm. earlier part of the day.
See, that's what I'm thinking, is that they had a protein bolus before their workout, because the other group didn't have much protein at breakfast, to kind of turn muscle protein synthesis on. And then the group that had like the more moderate at lunch, then they were able to recover at, like after their workout, they had another protein bolus. Whereas the group that was just very dinner heavy wasn't really supporting nutrient timing in that workout. So, I'd be curious as to see if this was all done in the morning, like the resistance training part of it. So, that was just a question that popped up in my head.
If it wasn't, that would be what we would call a limitation of the study. Now, one thing I will say, let's assume that they did not, and I don't think they did control for that. In my opinion, nutrient timing matters much less when you're beginning. Okay. As you get more trained, more advanced, and then I would say especially elite, mm-hmm. now that becomes more and more important. Or if we're talking about bodybuilders, as they get leaner and leaner in their contest preparation stages, the importance of nutrient timing becomes more and more important. So even if it weren't controlled for in this study, which would be a limitation, mm-hmm. it wouldn't concern me as much given this population of subjects who were new to resistance training.
That makes sense. Chris, did you have questions for Dr. Campbell on this study?
No, the nutrient timing around the workout was my only question as well. I do want to say I feel like these reviews are written very well. Like, it was easy to read and follow. So for people that may be intimidated by reading research, Bill Campbell, I think you did an excellent job of making it like palatable for a lot of people.
Well, you just made my day, because that's I take a lot of time and effort to do that, because yes, that's another thing just about my profession, like in academia, a lot of people who are professors, they try to be smarter than everybody in the room, and that doesn't study. So yeah, if I can write this in a way that my wife can understand it, then I've done my job. So thank you for that compliment.
And of course,
what does your wife do for a living, by the way? I'm curious.
My wife, when we got married, she was a CPA. We got married, we had children, so she now stays home. She handles, she handles everything in my life, the home, the kids' homework, the school, and she still does all of our finances. And she does a little bit of consulting on the side with her CPA background.
Okay. Yeah. So she's like my husband, the money, and like, he's a finance guy as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and just because you asked, right now she's literally cutting up boards with a saw for some trim work in our bathroom. So she's much more I like to tell people I'm handy or give the impression, but she's the more handy person as well.
Well, I guess, did you want to talk about, before we move on to the second study, did you want to talk about any limitations that you saw or any of that study number one, their strengths that they had in particular that you wanted to share with the audience before we move on?
Yeah, so and every issue that I have when I review a study, I also, as you're suggesting, I talk about what was good about this study and what was not good about this study. And so I use the word strengths and limitations to go over this. So the one thing that I thought they did very well was they actually executed on the protein distribution aspect. As a researcher, it's hard to get people to follow nutrition instructions. It's hard, but they did a really good job of this. And they use supplements to help with that to make it easier. Some of the limitations were they didn't control for body water. I always like there to be a body water assessment just because that can influence lean muscle mass if there is a potential for a person to retain more body water, or if they're somewhat dehydrated, that would also be a potential, or it is a limitation in this case. The other main limitation was that, yes, it was good in the terms of the protein distribution. They nailed that. But they didn't give what I would deem, or I know what you would deem, as an optimal amount of protein in the study. So I typically like to say, hey, at least 1.6 grams per kilogram of body mass, but closer to 2.2, which would be like a gram per pound of body weight. They gave, I believe it was about 1.4 grams per kg. So they didn't give an optimal amount of protein to their subjects to optimize muscle mass. So that was another limitation. And then also another limitation, of which I can honestly say now I'm humbled, was the lack of the nutrient timing that you guys have highlighted. And I wish I had thought of that when I was writing my own limitations.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. I take that as a huge compliment. I think you're very, you did a really good job of breaking this down. Like Chris mentioned, just echoing that, I felt like it was very interesting to read these, and it's very, like she said, palatable. I think that's the best way to educate and teach people, is just to make it so that, you know, everyone understands, and it makes research accessible to people. So thank you for that. Okay, so moving on to the second study, does eating processed food make it more difficult to maximize your physique? So if you can share a little bit of background information about that one, I thought this one was very interesting as well.
Yeah, so this study is, I would say, incredible. Like, this is a landmark study. It's the only study, the only controlled study where they actually measured a highly processed food diet. They called it an ultra processed food diet, and its impacts on somebody's body composition, particularly their body weight. And let me just give a little bit of background. I think in our space, there are two types of people. There are people who are fit, and they really gravitate towards eating good foods, nutrient dense foods. They tend not to snack too much. They're very cautious about what they put into their bodies. And then there are people who want to have a different approach. They want to have the best physique that they want, but they want to eat as much what historically people would call junk food. So how much processed foods, how many snacks, how many cookies, how many chips can they fit into their diet and still make progress? So I think this study really highlights, okay, if you're going to do that, here's what you can expect, with some assumptions in place. This study was a relatively short study, but it is the best, most controlled study on the effects that ultra-processed foods have on your body. So what they did, this was a what I call a metabolic ward study or an inpatient study. That's where all of the subjects in the study, they lived in a facility where they could be observed 24 hours a day, 7 days per week. And this was, what they did was they had subjects live in this metabolic facility for about a month.
Wow.
And they had them, yes. That's so the expense of that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, who funded that? That's expensive.
Very expensive. And not only are they having to pay them to live there and not, you know, and put their lives on hold, they're paying for mm-hmm. all of their food, all of the assessments. Mm-hmm. So, and the other good thing that they did was they had all of the subjects, they had them follow both diet interventions. So for 2 weeks, they were followed an unprocessed food diet. Mm-hmm. And then they had 2 weeks where they were following an ultra processed food diet. And they split the subjects up. So half of them started with the ultra processed food diet. And then the other half started with the non or unprocessed food diet. So there wasn't any what we would call a time effect in this study. So it was very well controlled. The other thing that they did, which is amazing, all the food was provided, all of the snacks, and what was given to the subjects during their 2 week diets. Remember that all subjects had two of these 2 week diets. The diets were matched for macronutrients, for sodium, for fiber, for protein. So typically when I eat a highly processed food diet, I'm getting much less protein, much more sodium. They controlled for all of that.
Okay.
Now the only way you do that is if you hire a bunch of dietitians and a kitchen staff that can formulate these diets. So again, talking about the expense, this was in the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars in my estimation. They didn't say how much it was, but knowing what I know about research and the assessments that they did, very, very expensive study. So if they're giving these subjects the same calories, the same nutrient profile, what makes them different? Well, the only thing that made them different was all of the food in one group was unprocessed foods. All of the foods given to the other intervention was highly or ultra processed foods. And the difference was the subjects could eat as much of the food that they wanted or as little as they wanted. So as an example, the researcher said, here's your 800 calorie processed food breakfast. Just like they would say, here's your 800 calorie non-processed food breakfast. Mm-hmm. And the subjects could eat two breakfasts, three breakfasts, half a breakfast. Then after breakfast, if they wanted a snack, they were provided snacks that were either like apples or potato chips. Again, just thinking of the type of diet that they were following. So that's what made the study different. And ways that they were able to standardize the macronutrients and sodium and fiber was just adding like Metamucil to the lemonade to equalize the adding salt to different foods.
Gotcha.
So that's how they did that, because again, that's very hard to do.
That was actually one of the things that I had written down as a question for you about this is because they didn't list the fiber, or at least it wasn't on your review. And I wasn't sure, because that's like one of the things that I feel like in when people track macros, you know, they can be really good at tracking protein, carbs, and fats, but they forget that the fiber element is really, you really need to hit a fiber number. Otherwise, you know, your carbs and things can have almost zero fiber. And so that's very cool that they did that. I think that will have, that has a huge impact on fullness and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. So let's go to the results. What they realized after the 2 weeks was the ultra processed food diet caused a significant increase in weight gain. It was about 2 pounds. And the other group, they actually lost about 2 pounds. So when they were eating the non-processed food diet, they lost 2 pounds. The other group eating an ultra-processed food diet gained 2 pounds. Now, they also did do body composition assessments. I don't put too much confidence in that because it was only 2 weeks long. So it's a very short period of time to really appreciate, did they gain muscle? Did they lose muscle? And the reality is they weren't resistance training, so we wouldn't expect them to gain muscle. But typically, if you gain weight, some of that's going to be from body fat and some's going to be from lean mass stores. Then we ask, well, why did they gain this weight? And the easy answer is, what I think most people could predict, is they ate significantly more calories. So essentially what the authors reported was that when the subjects were following the ultra processed food diet, they were on average each day eating 500 more calories per day. And that makes sense. That's what we believe to be true. But now we actually have a study that has reported this. We've known that a highly processed food diet doesn't, you need to eat more of it to feel full. So then there was one other aspect that kind of puzzled me at first. The researchers also measured appetite scores, or how hungry the subjects were. And I would have thought they would have reported the people following the ultra-processed food diet were significantly hungrier, or they perceived their hunger to be higher. But it wasn't. It was actually the same. And again, I'm like, wow, that's surprising. But then it dawned on me that the reason that they weren't hungrier was because they ate 500 more calories per day. So in order for them to not feel as hungry eating the ultra-processed food diet as compared to the non-processed food diet, they had to eat significantly more calories. So ultimately, it's the same outcome. If you're going to eat a lot of foods that are ultra-processed, you're going to be hungrier. And if you're not going to be hungry, you're going to have to eat more of those foods to give you that feeling of fullness. And as we saw in this study, the results were pretty profound, that there was a 4 pound weight difference between the two groups over the 2 weeks. And remember, they were allowed to eat. They were not told to eat a specific amount. This was ad libitum. Eat whatever you want to do, or don't eat if you don't want to eat.
Yeah. And protein was exactly the same too, because that's another thing that really satiates people. So they had that calculated to the gram that they were eating the exact amount of protein as well.
Yeah. I don't want to say to the gram. It could have been to the gram. I don't know if that would be technically true, but yes, they were equated in terms of what they gave them to start. Now, okay. What was different is they started to, the subjects, you know, they had more serving sizes of breakfast, lunch, dinner, or snacks because of not feeling as full. And maybe it's very possible by virtue of that they got some more protein, but it probably wouldn't have been much because the ultra processed food diets, especially if it were coming from snacks, and I think it was the snacks. I don't remember it. Those wouldn't have been much higher in the snacks. Typically, you know, potato chips, cookies, they're not higher protein foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed some of them were like goldfish and things like that. So yeah, mostly just carbs and fats.
Yes. Yep.
So Chris, did you have any questions for Dr. Campbell about study number two?
I don't think so. I was looking at the menu though and was very curious. Did they have a different menu each day, Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, so based on my memory, they had a 7-day rotating diet.
Okay.
So it was, so for two, let's just say the unprocessed group, they had the same diet for the first week. And like Monday had a breakfast, Tuesday had a breakfast, sure. Wednesday had a different breakfast. And then that was repeated in the second week.
Okay.
And then the same thing was true of the other group. And this study was, sometimes studies are open access, which means anybody can read them for free. And I can even use the figures in the studies. This study was not open access. So I provided, I took the data that they provided in their study, and I just made my own table so that people could see. So I'll give an example here just to give people an idea. So the unprocessed breakfast, as an example, breakfast was oatmeal, blueberries, raw almonds, and 2% milk. That was the unprocessed. The ultra-processed breakfast was pancakes with syrup and margarine, turkey sausage, tater tots, and apple juice. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of the different foods in this.
Yeah, very interesting. That's what I was wondering, is if people were eating the same thing every day, if they would start getting tired of having the same thing, and if, you know, highly palatable foods are more enticing, that they would eat more of that, they're okay eating more of that consistently, or if there was some variety in their menu plans. But that makes a lot of sense, and that was a great example in your review as well.
Yeah, so there was I would say there was a lot of variety. It was just repeat, like they never had the same breakfast or the same lunch more than 2 days over a 2 week period.
Got it. Okay,
so I think, you know, you mentioned a couple of the strengths. Any sort of limitations that you feel like stood out to you, or strengths that you haven't talked about thus far?
One of the things, and I praise the researchers for confining the subjects in this metabolic ward for a month. That's really good because you have so much control over them. But that's also a limitation, because the subjects are not driving by Taco Bell. They're not tempted to stop at Dairy Queen to get a milkshake.
Yeah.
So now they have vending. I think they had vending machines for their snack options, and they weren't limited in their snacks, but they limit by living in this controlled environment. They weren't tempted with the drive-bys, as I call it, of fast food. So that would be a limitation. The other thing was, it was only a 2 week intervention, so 4 weeks total, but each person was on each diet for 2 weeks. In our world, there was no, you know, these subjects were sedentary. So how would resistance training impact the outcome of this study? But I would say where this study really helps, the message is, especially if we have physique coaches that are working with a new client who's new in their fitness journey, I think the take-home message from this study is, you can eat processed foods, but if you do, there's going to be a consequence to them. And that consequence is, you're going to be hungrier. You're going to eat those foods and they're not going to satisfy your hunger. The only way that you're going to satisfy your hunger is by eating significantly more calories of those foods. So I think that's the message. And again, I'm not one to say don't eat processed foods. I'd be a hypocrite. I eat processed foods. I had a small bag of Doritos right before we started our But I also would say, I know that when I have that small bag of Doritos, that is not going to, that's not the best, my best friend for giving me a feeling of fullness or satiation, as would something that's a little more non-processed. Let's say a bowl of oatmeal with some whey protein on top of, you know, with mixture.
Sure. Yeah, I think that study can be directly applied in our industry as well, with people reversing out of shows. Like, I just spoke with a client yesterday, and with, you know, hunger hormones spiked, being super lean, just educating her, and I was able to actually cite this review about food choices helping in the assistance of like increasing or helping with calorie input, and just being able to like make good food choices to help the eliminating of like just eating continuously or not having control over what's, you know, controlling satiety basically. So yeah, that's just another thing that I think that directly applies.
Yes. Yeah. I agreed.
So can you give the listeners a little bit of information about if they want to subscribe to this, what is the process of doing that? And then, how often do you put out these reviews, and what's kind of your game plan for that?
Yes. The each issue comes out monthly, and in each issue I summarize two research studies. And again, it's the research review. It's called Body by Science. It's solely focused on building muscle and losing body fat, and in some cases maintaining muscle if it's a dieting study. And it launched every month. I release them in the middle of the month, typically the 15th of every month. And my goal when I made this was I wanted it to be, I didn't want cost to be a barrier to people. So I knowingly priced this in my mind low. So currently it's $6.99 per month. And I will say that's a launch price at some point, and I don't know whether that's November, December, but the price will increase. But now it's $6.99 per month. And the way that you can get it, if you go to my website, which is pretty easy to remember, it's BillCampbellPhD.com. You can download the issue that we just talked about for free to see if you like it, and you can purchase it there. Again, if you purchase that now, probably till the end of the year, I would think it will be $6.99 per month.
Okay. And is that just like a continuous billing cycle? It auto drafts on the 15th, yes. Kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then it gets emailed to you.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I had to learn when I did this. I had to learn a lot about the finance side of this. So, you get billed.
That's for your wife, right?
Yeah, my wife handles all of this stuff. She handles the. So the day that you sign up for this, let's say, what's today? Today's the 11th, I think. So
yep.
If you sign up today, it's the 11th, and then you get billed every month on the 11th going forward. Okay. Oh, also, if you do purchase this, you get the current month's issue. And also you have access to the previous month's issue. So if you buy this of October, and you would get, what was the month? September. So you would have, no, October hasn't been launched. So right now, if you buy it, you get September and August. So you always get 1 month's previous issue as well.
Okay. And when did you start it? So how many issues do you have out currently?
I started this in July. So July, August, September. So right now there have been three issues that have been launched. I'm about the end of this week, there'll be four. So that'll be October. And my plan is once I get to the 6 month mark, I will offer a bundle for people who haven't subscribed at all, who want those back issues. I just thought about that enough yet, but I decided to do that before I launched this. So I will offer bundles for people who want back issues.
I like that idea. And what is, and this is, something I've noticed that you have certain experts in the field. What's your process of selecting those people?
Yeah. So these are experts in the field, and typically they are physique coaches, physicians, sometimes researchers, dietitians. And I guess right now my selection criteria is just people that are already in my network, people that I've known and trust them, that they're ethical in their recommendations to their clients. Mm-hmm. Now I know over time I will have to get to the point where I don't, my network is only so big, mm-hmm. But that's pretty much it. Somebody that I know personally and have seen their work. And in some cases, like in this, that the inaugural issue, Lauren Conlon was a former student of mine, and she's built a very successful online coaching business. Mm-hmm. Paul Revelia is a physique coach that I've known. He lives near me. Mm-hmm. I've known him for many, many years as well. So yeah, I guess at this point it's a good old boys or good old girls network of people that I've to learn to trust and value how they work with their clients.
Yeah, that sounds good. Chris, did you have any other questions about the review or for Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, I have one question, Dr. Campbell. How do you choose which research to review?
What the studies I'm choosing, at least at this point, again, I'm only 4 or 5 months into this, are the studies that I think have impacted the way that we the way that we practice physique enhancement. So they're the most powerful studies. Like in one example, I don't know, maybe that's the issue coming out in October. No, actually, it's the current issue. I've summarized a study that was published in the year 2000. So it's literally 22 years old. And in that same issue, I reviewed another study that's not even published yet. So it's so new, not even published. But typically the studies are relatively new. But I also really love the studies that are landmark studies that have informed us of the best practices to build muscle and lose fat. So as long as the study meets that threshold of this study should change or validate, if you're already a good coach, how you work with clients. If it meets that threshold, that's what it gets included. So I'm going to take off my humble hat here for a second. I believe that every single study is very impactful. I don't think there's going to be many studies in my research review that just aren't that exciting or that mm-hmm. don't have a lot of relevance to what people do who are either coaches or are serious about their exercise and nutrition programming.
Yeah, I am noticing the quality of the content that's chosen, and that's why I was curious. Like, I think, you know, everyone can pump out content, but making sure that it's relevant to, you know, your personal mission. And just looking at the specific things you said or you have reviewed, I could tell that you're definitely staying in line with that. So, yeah, that's great. Keep up the great work.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making me feel good about the work I'm doing.
Sure.
Yeah, and I love I love following you on Instagram. You always have little quizzes that I try to answer before I look at the answer in the content box. So I know that our listeners would be interested in following you as well on IG. Can you share your handle with us and any other items in terms of, you know, if people wanted to be a student, where should they go to find you and connect with you and, you know, tag you on their story when they talk about, you know, listening to you today to show you appreciation.
Yeah. So Instagram is the only social media platform that I'm currently on. And my handle is Bill Campbell, PhD. And just if what I do on there is kind of what you alluded to, I'm a professor, so I give exams. So essentially every day I give a quiz or multiple choice question, or I just talk about what, you know, something professional, or I brag about some conference or something that I spoke at recently. So it's very educational, where I'm trying to just elevate the knowledge base about optimizing your physique in a healthy and sustainable way, essentially. And if anybody is interested in going to school, like we have a master's program in exercise science, I think initially just reach out to me through Instagram. And then for people that are interested in attending University of South Florida, I'll quickly just say, hey, email me at my USF email. And then I take that conversation there.
Awesome. Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it. And I will put the link for, you know, subscribing to your review, and we'll put your also your handle in the show notes just in case people miss that. Thank you so much for your time again. I really, really appreciate it. I always learn something.
Yes, thank you guys. Anytime people tell me how great I am and how much they like what I do, it's very easy to sit here and do this.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. All right. If you would like to find us on Instagram, we are at Prep Life Podcast or at Glam Girl Bikini. Be sure to tag us on your story and let Dr. Campbell know what you thought of this episode. You can apply for the team at glamgirlbikini.com by hitting the Get Started button. This is your founder and CEO, Amy Enger, signing off with my fabulous co-host.
And this is Chris Nicole, Glam Girl Bikini Coach and IFBB Bikini Pro. Thanks for listening, everyone.